Good day, all, and greetings. Welcome to Health Coach Radio once again. It's Dr. Mark Percival here, and I'm actually in La Jolla, California with Dr. Gregory Kelly, and I trust that Dr. David Hosse will be joining us from Clarksville, Tennessee. Are you with us, David?
Yes, I am, but I had my mute on, so you couldn't tell that a little bit ago.
All right. Well, glad to have you with us live, and spunky as always, I'm sure. And Dr. Rick Perryman, have you been able to join us from Phoenix?
I have.
Great, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, this is, we posted to speak today to the latest book out by Michael Pollan, In Defense of Food, which is quite a provocative title. Who'd have thought anyone would be defending food several hundred years ago, where people, if they didn't go out and till the soil and care to the lifestyle needs of their animals on their farm or know a farmer who could do that for them, were hard-pressed to feed their families. And nowadays, so few know more than where to go to purchase food. And even then, the definition of food is very much controversial these days. And in reading Michael Pollan's initial book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is an excellent book that we highly recommend, his findings as a research journalist have so mirrored what we've found in our experience, both in our undergraduate and graduate and postgraduate studies, and most importantly, our personal experience and our clinical work with respect to food and what the important considerations are. We think both his works are very noteworthy, and because his book, In Defense of Food, is once again on a bestseller list and is quite topical these days, we thought it would be good to visit some of the distinctions that Michael's working along really in parallel or tandem with us to bring into the awareness of the consumer here in North America. So, Greg, I know you were especially interested in the interview that you had linked us to originally around Michael's work, and I think if we haven't already, we will post that link on our webpage, on our eRadio site, so we'll make sure we do that. But, Greg, why don't you kick it off by sharing with us some of your thoughts as you were reviewing Michael's work and how you thought that was pertinent to what we're doing here at Health Coach.
Sure. Well, I think one of the most important places to start is he begins the book with seven words, and those words are eat food, not much of it, mostly plants. And he then, in essence, goes into the next 200 pages of the book to elaborate on that simple sentence and to give us the readers algorithms for getting back towards finding foods in our local food supply, whether that be our supermarket, health food stores, farmers markets, et cetera, that would, in essence, meet that definition. And in the journey to take us there, he then also goes into some pretty good detail into what's, you know, in essence, the forces that have put our food supply under attack, so to speak, requiring some defense of it. So I think it, you know, probably is a good place to start by talking about what he means by food, because if the listeners are, you know, I guess have similar access to what I have here when I go to my, you know, big supermarket store or health food store, the illusion is that we have, you know, tens of thousands of choices of different food items to consume, and in truth, the vast majority of those wouldn't meet his real straightforward definition of food. So anything to add into that kind of opening team before we move forward talking about his term food and the vast sea of other that's in our supermarkets?
I've just heard the term recently called Frankenfood, referring to Frankenstein and things that aren't real, and we've got a lot of that for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, we've still lost a connection with where our food comes from, and I resonate with Michael in first starting with, you know, what is food and how would we define food, because people are frequently asking us as, you know, as clinicians and with respect to our roles at Health Coach is, you know, what do we eat? And before we can really answer that, I think the fundamental question is really what qualifies as food first and foremost, and then to get into the various nourishment aspects of that discussion. So I think that's a great place to start, Greg.
Good.
And I would also add that there's very little connection to where food comes from any longer. We, you know, Greg, it was fascinating to me you just saying you're going to your supermarket, and I still think about going out to my garden for food. And my family in South Dakota still, we eat our animals that come directly off of the land, and we have a deep connection to food. And so that was just interesting. I would have probably introduced this whole topic differently, and as opposed to in that way. So it was just fun to hear you say that.
Well, I'd love to hear your introduction.
Let's start all over. No, we just rewound.
No, that's not it at all. It's just instead of asking you, or it's exactly asking the same question. You know, how do you come to a definition of food? And it's usually the things that you've absorbed. It's the environment in which you've been raised. It's not one of the questions that we get asked in elementary school. You know, we're asked, you know, what's 2 + 2 and then it equals 4, but we're not asked a simple question like what is food, which is going to have a massive impact in our life. So it's such an important question, and people may say, well, that's awful obvious, but if you don't deal with the foundations, you can't go any further with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your introduction was just fine, Greg.
Oh, I felt good about it, but just thought it would be nice to hear your different one, having come from a family background where you had much more direct access to the land and its products than I did growing up in a more urban area. So.
And it really is, you know, once we ask the question, what is food, then it follows, where does that food come from? What are the implications with respect to various places that our food comes from, or where our food chain originates today, and why the implications, not only the personal health implications, but the social health implications, and from a ecological standpoint, sustainability standpoint, what are the implications? Because these are, you know, in addition to the question of what is food, which, as you pointed out, David, would confound probably even a high schooler today. We get a wide variety of responses to that, and as well as from their parents, very evidently by what kids march off with for lunch or go do for lunch, et cetera, with so many kids getting the majority of their food and meals from fast food sources nowadays, including fast food school lunch programs. There really is a number of questions that beg to be answered that I think Poland does an excellent job, you know, in his Omnivore's Dilemma, that book is worthwhile just from reading the first section to deepen your understanding of how corn has come to be a commodity these days and how it is utilized within our culture and within our food chain today and all the different ramifications of that. Profoundly important for every individual making choices on a daily basis to understand the implications, even of just that one aspect of our food chain in the current economics around our food choices today. So I strongly encourage those listening to this to make sure that they go out and get both books and start probably with the Omnivore's Dilemma first and foremost, because the level of detail he goes into around some of these aspects is very, very novel and very worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. So I for me, when I think of the question is what is food, because it's something long before I heard of Michael Pollan, that in my approach to shape and weight was a fundamental part of my, you know, approach was about food quality and teaching about that. And the very beginning question there was, you know, what is food? Because, you know, I've heard many people say, well, the reason people are overweight is because they eat too much food. I would say, in the most simple sense, they might be ingesting too much of something, but I've never met an overweight person yet in my life that eats too much food. And so, you know, right out of the gate, for me, it's important to make a distinction, just like he has, between food and what he would call food-like substances. So the old definition of food, if we were to go back to what he would say, like let's go back to what our great-great-grandparents would have recognized as food, we can probably use that as our baseline for what still would qualify for food. If it wasn't something that they ate and recognized as food, then it probably isn't. And I think that's a relatively good rule of thumb. And the reason for that is because food at one point was defined basically as something that could provide nourishment to our body, something that would allow us to generate health and long life. Where I'm not exactly sure when this definition changed, but the legal definition of food in the U.S. now and in Canada by the agencies that are responsible for the safety of our food supply has evolved into something that basically is, if it can reasonably expect it to be ingested by human beings, whether in liquid or solid food, it's food. Which is obviously a huge demarcation or departure from what would have qualified from food even 60 years ago, much less back in the times of my great-grandparents. And so what that then leads us to is we walk into, you know, even a big health food store, and the vast majority of what's in there has ingredients that, frankly, my great-grandmother would never be able to decipher. Certainly, much of the packaging, the processing that the food's undergone wouldn't have been things that existed at all in her lifetime or, you know, the lifetimes of my great-grandparents, the males. And so what's really evolved in the U.S. and Canada to a large extent is we're fooled by the appearance of these 40,000 or so different SKUs, so these 40,000 different choices we might have in a big supermarket of items we could buy, where in the truth, the vast majority of those are just different formulations of corn, soy, and wheat, and the chemicals and compounds extracted from those. And so what we've really become in North America is a population that consumes somewhere between 70 and 80% of our calories from those three foods. And if we were then to talk in terms of indirect, since corn and soy are the staples for most of the livestock we then eat as meat, indirectly we're eating a lot of corn and soy when we consume a mass-produced or industrially produced hamburger or steak or piece of chicken. And so we've really taken what in our great-grandparents' time was small, diversified, sustainable farms that were connected to the land, took good care of the soil, saved seeds every year so they could plant those and have a new crop, into a completely different relationship with farming, where there's these, you know, monstrous farms that buy genetically modified seeds from companies like Monsanto that then buy their pesticides and herbicides to be able to grow these, in essence, undiversified crops year after year from other chemical companies that then sell all their corn and soy to a few big middlemen that then, you know, turn those into things like mono and diglycerides and partially hydrogenated oils and cornstarch and high fructose corn syrup, and the list goes on and on. If we were to buy a Twinkie and read the long list of ingredients, either the ingredients are, you know, from corn or soy, or are some directly petrochemical based manufactured synthetic ingredient. So what we've really moved towards is a nation that has a very undiversified diet, supports a very unsustainable form of agriculture, and the ramifications, I think, you know, are evident in the health crisis that's sweeping North America.
Greg, I think one
of
the...
Greg, what that reminds me of is the Monty Python skit of what would you like for breakfast? You can have egg spam spam or spam spam eggs or egg spam egg spam or, you know, in multiple different combinations of these same two ingredients, which sounds absolutely ridiculous in a Saturday Night Live skit, but when we go to our supermarket, it's absolutely tragic. But it's less evidence. It's, what's that?
Or my favorite of theirs is the cheese shop that has no cheese. We could work into that one, the cheese food concept. So.
Or the cheese food. I love Greg's definition of cheese food. It's food that cheese eats.
Well, one of the distinctions that Poland makes that I think is so worthwhile is when he talks about the ability of science now to be able to identify the source of the actual carbon that makes up the life form. So as carbon life forms that you've heard in many sci-fi movies, and certainly in any of you who grew up with Star Trek, we carbon life forms as humans, they can actually identify by analyzing human tissue the source of those carbons which are essential to all life. And the sources of those carbons in human beings now are hugely corn-related,
There are some soy and some wheat, but we are more corn people than anything else in our culture today, which he goes on to point out how that came to be and how that ties in with government decisions and the subsidization of the corn crop, et cetera, especially during the Nixon era, which is just absolutely fascinating. I think it's very important that people understand the politics of the food choices that we have available to us in our supermarket today. And one of the other key ingredients required for life is nitrogen, as most probably realize. And the main source of that nitrogen now is synthesized ammonium nitrate, which it comes from petroleum sources. So it's very important that we understand the implications. And if you go back to the ecology of our food chain and you look at to produce one calorie of food energy from corn, and corn is a unique plant in that it's incredibly efficient in producing food energy from other sources of energy, but we still invest approximately 10 calories of fossil fuel for every calorie of food fuel that we create via growing corn and subsidizing corn in our economy today. It's profound how inefficient from an energy cycle our production of our food is, and then let alone what we do to it before it gets to we consumers. So it's very worthwhile to become more familiar with that, because you might go, gee, I don't eat hardly any corn. Well, when you realize that the chickens are fed on corn and the eggs that they produce are largely based on corn, and you look at that the same with, you know, pork, you look at the same with beef, you look at all the different food products and byproducts and high fructose corn syrup, which makes up a huge percentage of people's total carbohydrate intake in North America, you soon see the case for why we can be referred to as the corn people or the corn, soy, and wheat people with a little more, you know, broader terms. So.
Wow. You know, that when you start pondering these questions, you ask the big question, well, how did we get here? And it kind of takes me back to Deep Throat's quote to Bob Woodward in the movie All the President's Men, mm-hmm. when they were trying to figure out the Nixon scandal. And he says, follow the money. Follow the money, Bob. And having grown up on a family farm in South Dakota, having seen crops being raised from the ground, and recognizing that my father was getting paid about $2.60 for a bushel of corn, which most deconditioned individuals couldn't even lift a bushel of corn. That's a very substantial amount of weight there. So $2.50, and yet the amount of corn that would go into a box of cornflakes was equivalent to anywhere between 2 and 4 cents worth of actual corn. So we're trying to calculate how much, you know, that you could actually fill about with 4 or 5 bushels of corn, fill a very substantial amount of a semi with cornflakes in their respective packaging. This is an incredibly profitable game to take raw materials, real foods, cut them up, smash them up, process them, repackage them, reformulate them, make them chemically deeply desirous to the human palate, even addictive to the human palate,
yeah.
and then to sell them at an enormous profit. It's remarkable to start thinking about that. So.
That's
it's following the money.
It's profitable to everyone except people like your dad.
Correct.
Every other person made a whole bunch of money on it, but the farmer that grew it is probably going slightly deeper into debt almost every year, having grown acres and acres of corn.
That is certainly correct.
I think I read somewhere that, you know, of the dollar we would pay for, say, a box of cornflake, about less than half a penny of that would find its way into the pocket of the farmer that grew the corn. Where conversely, if we were to buy a whole food, like an egg at our supermarket, even one that wasn't necessarily the highest quality egg, you know, maybe a third of the dollar we spend on that to 40% of it would find its way directly into the farmer's pocket. So without question, the choices that we make in terms of buying our food are, in essence, a vote with our money for who we want to support and see thrive, big agribusiness or the small farmer.
So So let's turn our discussion towards the alternatives. Let's turn it towards more solution, like Michael does in his second book, the In Defense of Food, and help our listeners make decisions that, for those who want to make decisions for personal health reasons, for more socially conscientious reasons and ecologically sustainable reasons, they can begin to make, because I think Michael does a reasonably good job in his In Defense of Food of pointing out some of the simple distinctions that people can begin to make that start to, where they can become more part of the solution than part of the problem.
Absolutely. Well, one of those, and it's one I know we've at Health Coach taught for as long as I've known you, Mark, is to shop at the periphery of your markets, whether there's the health food markets or the big supermarkets.
Absolutely, and so people understand that. So they, when you walk into a grocery store, what are you greeted with? Typically the floral section, you're greeted with the live, colorful plant life. So you usually walk in, there's the flower shop, and then you face the produce. So there's the promise of, you know, whole real foods. And moving towards the middle of the store, you have the much more prepackaged, industrialized foods available. But we also want to point out that many of those foods that you're seeing in the produce area now, too, have been produced through more industrial means than have been produced through what we should say, traditional methods of raising food and growing food, because you really will need typically, although some food store chains make a commitment to buy more local produce, you'll often need to move even more peripheral than the actual store and go to, for example, farmers markets in your areas or become part of crop share programs, as an example. And you might go, well, gee, this is too much work. That's where I strongly encourage you, for example, to read Michael's books and to participate, if you aren't already, in our ShapeShift educational programs, because the more informed you become, the more compelled you'll be to make these decisions, and you'll soon see that there's a lot more considerations in the space that are important than just the cost of the food before you, because if you don't pay for better quality food, that's what we're speaking to today, and we could translate this in a variety of different areas, but if you don't pay for better quality food, you're going to be paying for more expensive health care, and the studies over and over have now confirmed that. So there was a time where we spent much more per a higher percentage of our income on food than we do today, about double what we do today. One of the things is that the agribusiness has done is reduced the cost of food-like substances and has made it easier for people to eat more cheaply or inexpensively. However, what the cost of that is we've seen in direct proportion the increase in healthcare expenses virtually double. So as we've halved what we spend on food, we've doubled our expenditure on healthcare. And in other words, treating the aftermath of making choices that don't support our health and nourish us in appropriate ways that maintain us and allow us to maintain our health. So it's very, very interesting as you understand more about this whole aspect of both health and the economics and the political science behind it. Your choices begin to shift in accord with that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if anything, I think, you know, if we were to go back 40 years ago between the kind of the annual health care expenses a family might pay and their food bill, it represented probably somewhere between 20 to 23% of their earnings, where now we spend much less on food but much more on health. And so that total has actually gone up to about 26 or 27%. So,
excuse me, Greg. Actually, we spend more on food-like substances.
Food-like substances, correct. And so it's, you know, I guess one of the things when I hear people say, you know, eating quality foods costs more, that's true. It costs more for that food because you are now buying real food, but it actually directly can save that family money over time in terms of their health care expenditures. And the hidden costs of food-like substances between the subsidies our taxes are paying for, the damage to our environment that these chemicals are causing, et cetera, is really incalculable. So, you know, there's really no way from a true cost that high-quality food is anything other than a bargain.
I would imagine personal productivity measures applied to that as well would drive that number even higher.
Yep.
And what we've always advocated as health coach is make more informed choices. There's no reason not to learn more about where our food comes from and what the full implications of that are, both from a personal health standpoint and from a socially conscientious standpoint and a global ecology standpoint. Really, ignorance is not bliss, and the more you understand about our food chain and about the impact of the choices that we make as individuals, the choice is then yours. You are free to make it. You are not free to make choices when you don't realize what choices you really do have and what the full implications, or at least the broader implications, of those food choices really are. So what we really advocate is we aren't against people consuming things with corn or soy, and as a matter of fact, it'd be totally unreasonable. It's almost unavoidable at this point. What we are for is you become more informed and you make choices based on your personal values, your personal ethics and goals for you and your future in future generations here on this planet. And as you do so and become more informed, you'll find yourself following, Michael's, what he's captured in a very simple, concise opening sentence about foods and, eating real foods and eating less of it. It's such simple wisdom and things often that maybe your great-grandparents once spoke to you, but the choices at the supermarket take on a new light, or at the farmer's market take on a new light when you become more informed about what the ramifications of those really are. So let's talk about some other things that people can begin to do that have an impact on them consistent with...
Well, I would say that how you assess food... there's one other thing. If we're supposed to eat foods like our grandmother has eaten or our great-grandmother would have eaten, we should assess those foods and their quality like she would have done. She would have gone into or been encountering a certain amount of food. She would smell it. She would take a look. Is it a vibrant color? Is it fresh? Is it something that is in season? Is it something that... those would be the things that she would be doing to assess this particular food. She wouldn't be reading a label. She wouldn't be asking, well, how much vitamin E is in this? She would be really taking a look, wow, is this wholesome? And would be thrilled when tomatoes were in season. And their family would be eating a tremendous number of tomatoes when they were in season, prefer often straight off of the vine. So I think that just like we're supposed to eat the types of foods, we have to think, well, how would great-grandma have decided, given this multitude of choices, even in the produce section? Oh, man, what a cornucopia is there. How should we decide and think like great-grandma?
Yeah, that brings me to like a question that I had this week in our Living the Shapeshift Lifestyle lesson that was dedicated to sourcing out the best quality butters in your local food chain. And, so a question I've gotten over the years working with people would be something to the effect of, is it okay to eat butter? Is butter good for me? Or something like that. And my answer is always the same. It's like, well, which butter are we talking about? Because there's a huge range of quality differences between the butter, even in my local Safeway, from what I would grade as butter that, if you eat it, that is likely going to contribute to you getting about the same health outcomes over the course of your lifetime that the average American gets, which are frankly pretty pathetic, to butters that are exceptional, and that if you use those as your source of butter, you can, probably expect significantly better long-term results if your other food choices are consistent with that butter and also being high quality. So I think, when we talk about your grandmother and now taste and smell, like, back 100 years ago, the average consumer knew what good butter was. Now the average consumer has no idea what that is. If it says butter on it, the look I would get is, what are you trying to tell me? Isn't all butter basically the same? And, yeah. And the truth is, no, it's not. It's a huge difference in terms of the quality fats in it and the vitamins and the other nutrients, based largely on things like what did the cow eat? Was it given growth hormones? Was it injected with hormones to get it to a milk-producing stage of its life cycle faster? Lots of different things.
Was it
like
pastured,
that.
Most importantly?
Yeah, pastured. And then, since it's probably been pasteurized after it came from the cow, was there anything to add life back into it? Was it cultured, as an example? So And then it also makes me think of another one, I guess the food-based rules that Poland suggests, and it's if a food in your store has to make some claim about why it's good for your health, it probably isn't. And, you know, that kind of brings me to, like, the promised margarine that, you know, both of us talked a little bit about, David. And so for those of you that aren't familiar, Promise is one of the leading brands of margarine, and at least according to Promise, the vast majority of cardiologists recommend it to their patients. So the truth is what Promise is it's primarily water and mono and diglycerides, which legalese term fall into this loophole where although mono and diglycerides are almost exclusively fatty acids, the same way that other fats would be, that because of the structure of the backbone of those, they can be claimed to not be fats. And so although we would, in mono and diglycerides, be getting maybe more saturated fats and more trans fats than we would even in a real high fat thing like another brand of margarine or vegetable shortening, they can legally claim that there's no calories in the product, although they'll be gram for gram as much as there would be in something like, you know, Crisco, and they can claim that there's no fat in it and no trans fat, although there are. And then right on the label, make a health claim about why this is good for your heart, even though there's no, you know, safety data showing that mono and diglycerides are even safe for long-term human consumption, and certainly not a shred of evidence that they're even safe for our heart, much less good for it. So the labeling claims, an important thing to understand is that those aren't predicated on anything other than food industry trying to come up with new marketing claims and exploit loopholes in the federal laws in the U.S. and Canada that allow quite often them to make claims that are absurd. So, you know, you'll never see a sticker on an avocado about how good it is for your heart, but in conventional nutritional sciences now, an avocado is thought of similar to an olive oil. It's got the same kind of monounsaturated fats, and the olive oil can't be standing up in the store yelling and screaming, "Hey, I'm really good for you." The leading health agencies now are all saying, "You know, I'm one of the best things for you to be eating," and yet this food-like substance called margarine, with this brand that has all, you know, in essence, highly processed fatty acids in it, claims how good it is for your heart, when I would say, you know, from everything I know, there couldn't be anything further from the truth than that.
And the bottom line of that is that even though it's, if you take a look at the label, it says like 5 calories per teaspoon, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually burn that, it's going to be 50 to 60 calories. I mean, everything in there is forms of fat, but the federal government, by its definition, doesn't call it fat. So it doesn't even fall into any criteria. And the way the food labels are created, it looks like you're eating air. And wow, it tastes like butter. How cool is that? And but it has nothing to ground it in reality. It's fat, and it's probably a form of fat that is highly non-beneficial for your system.
I think it's important to point out that one of the things you said in the U.S. and Canada, where there are significant lobbying efforts going on all the time in the food industry, that doesn't happen in the European Union. So Europeans have a very, very different look at and ideas about food. We have a good friend that comes from Belgium, and she moved over here recently, and it's fascinating to see how she reacts to American food and the stuff that's sold as food. Europeans look at that very, very differently.
Well, I think, and when I hear David explaining it, which I think he did a much better job than I did, you know, they claim 5 calories on the label. Those are the 5 that they're legally required to claim. The other 55 or so that are in the product, they're not legally required to list, so they just vanish into thin air from a label perspective. but they certainly wouldn't vanish into thin air when you put that product into your mouth.
And this is the rule, not the exception, so people know. This is not an isolated example that this is the name of the game, because the human beings only eat so much food. So when you've got a market like it exists in the United States or Canada, they only anticipate about a 1% growth rate in the population. That would mean a 1% growth rate for General Foods and for all the different companies associated with feeding America. And that's not acceptable on Wall Street. So what ends up happening is they either compete for market share, meaning that for brand identification, so that they can be identified as the breakfast cereal to consume. So they've got they've got teams of hundreds and hundreds of people working on how to influence your purchasing decisions at the supermarket so that you choose their brand over others. And they also are working in concert with all of the other vested interests to increase how much of that particular category of food you consume, which is what happened in the fast food industry, which had plateaued until they brought out supersizing. They found that by supersizing things, by providing those same foods more cheaply, where people wouldn't buy a second hamburger or a second set of French fries or a second pop because they didn't want to appear to be gluttons, they didn't want to be judged for going back and purchasing more. When it came to the supersizing concept, lo and behold, it caught on like wildfire, and people began to consume more of specific types of foods or categories of food, and it became quite a windfall for those vested interests in the fast food industry, but at the same time to the extraordinary detriment of the health of the less informed consumer today. And know that to varying extents we're all influenced by those decisions, and you can vote with your feet and your real world actions by becoming much more conscientious, and that requires you to become conscious of the impact of the decisions that you're making, where you begin to eat more whole, real foods. And we have advocated for the better part of 3 decades now at Health Coach the same wisdom that Michael Pollan advocates in his recent books, that you want to eat a more plant-based diet. That doesn't mean we're against consuming other foods, meaning the majority of your diet should be from plants, and it should be in the form of whole foods, and you should purchase fresh and local wherever possible. Those are just simple distinctions that if you begin to do that, you'll find yourself experiencing benefits that you just can't get virtually any other way, certainly not by eating foods with health claims on them. So, gentlemen, we're going to have to cut away. I have to drag Dr. Greg out of here to a meeting that's some distance away. So we're going to sign off on this end. Any closing remarks, David or Rick? And we can certainly come back to this topic multiple times over our radio shows in the weeks to come.
Well, I would want to close with just saying that, Greg, you're doing a phenomenal job in living the shape-shift lifestyle, going through the distinctions that really matter. I've had several of my patients rave about the information that they're getting. And so I just want to say great job. And to everybody else out there, bon appetit.
Yes, certainly. If you're interested in learning more about the impact of your foods and the various choices you can make, living the shape-shift lifestyle is by far the most current and cost-effective and efficient way to get that information now, without question. Rick, any comments on your end before we sign off?
I think we covered it.
Great. Terrific. Well, thank you for your time, co-hosts. We look forward to getting together next week, where we'll continue on with this particular topic, and make it a great week, everyone. Eat well. Be well.
Emails from